It's a lot safer to be in something that can move in times of change than to be in something that is rigid. I want to be in movement. I want to be where it's possible for things to continue to learn and grow and be. There's too much changing in our world, including myself, for me to be in a world where everything is locked around me.
The world is changing so fast, and the rules and practices and norms that we rely on for how to live and be in this world are disintegrating in a way that can leave us feeling untethered, uncertain, and vulnerable. This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. How do we live through this uncomfortable transition, this liminal space between what we once were and a future that we still really can't imagine? Today, I am speaking with Nora Bateson, an award-winning filmmaker, writer, and educator whose writings on complexity and change feel, to me, like they come from the future. We talk about relationships, about being in motion, and about the deep systemic work we need to do to liberate each other from the age of individualism. This conversation was a gift. Let's dig in. Complexity is such an important and at times elusive notion, and I can think of no one I'd rather talk to about it than Nora Bateson. Her life's work is about understanding, communicating, and embracing complexity, or in her words, the spiraling processes of the vast context that we are all participants in. Nora, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's such a pleasure, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
When I was first thinking up this podcast, I kept coming back to something that I read from you, I think, during the early days of the pandemic, and it was about how untethered and disorienting it can feel when systems begin to unravel and change around us. You know, when the parameters and the rules that we've become so comfortable with to orient ourselves become less valid. It's disquieting, unsettling, chaotic. And I take this as a sign that radical change may be closer than we think. What do you make of this premise? Where are we, do you think, with respect to seeing major change in the world around us?
I think a lot of that, the major change is already underway. And we are kind of running on the fumes of structures and habits of perception of structures. You know how when you look in the sky and people used to say, when you were a little kid, how amazing it is. You know, that star you're seeing, it could have blown up, whatever, 9 years ago, and you're still seeing it like it's right there. It's that thing of it takes a while to have the multiple ways in which our perception and our sense-making hold us in our world shift. So when we have some things that are still in place and other things that are not in place, our tendency is to perceive that everything is as it was, but everything isn't as it was. And we're not yet that clear on where the gaps are, where the threads have come loose, where there's no step in the stairway anymore.
It's as if we think all of the scaffolding around us is still there, but there are actually pieces missing.
Yeah, scaffoldings is a good word. And some of these things are deep. They're really, really deep. I remember the first time I bumped into this in a way that I could really capture it and say, oh yeah, this is a good example, was one Christmas in Sweden. And I was making mashed potatoes. And my Swedish husband came in and said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm making mashed potatoes. He said, no, we need boiled potatoes. It's Christmas. And I was like, boiled potatoes? I don't want boiled potatoes. I definitely want mashed potatoes because it's Christmas. And it was so unthinkable. I didn't see that he, for one minute, why he would want boiled potatoes. But in Sweden, you have a lot of fish things you have with boiled potatoes. And in our world, we have mashed potatoes. Okay, this is just an example of how deeply knitted these things are, so that when you take away the mashed potatoes, you're like, well, I don't know. I mean, was it Christmas dinner? Like, I didn't mash the potatoes, and so I'm not sure it happened. That was a really light example. Mm-hmm. A heavier example is going to look more like, you know, ideas about democracy or very serious concepts of what is work or success or what makes you attractive or worthwhile or what is mental health. Mm-hmm. And some of these things run really deep, really far back too. They could be 200 years ago that things started to get put in place that make it seem like this is just how life is.
You know, when major parts of society begin to change, like what it means to be good or right or successful or a man or a woman, people can feel really vulnerable. You know, a word for it might be liminality, the uncomfortable state when you're experiencing change. You're not what you used to be, but you're not what you're going to be. Mm-hmm. Because when you're in that state, it can be very enriching and invigorating, but you can also be very vulnerable. You know, people can take advantage of that. And I feel like that's something that we're seeing around the world with people who swoop in and try to take advantage of that and replace for you the parts of the scaffolding that have disappeared. And that gives them a lot of power. I'm stuck trying to figure out what to do about that, where you see people who are, you know, like Donald Trump, who are keen enough observers and opportunistic enough to take advantage of that opportunity and exploit it.
So this liminality that you're pointing to, it can be really usurped easily, because it's like it's the soil with the tiniest little seedlings in it. Mm-hmm. Right. And we live in a world that's just so eager for the harvest. You know, we don't have time to be in the seedlings. We want a 1 through 5 new rule book yesterday. Right. If I can't do this, then what can I do? Well, like, wait a minute, we don't know yet. And the wait a minute, we don't know yet part is susceptible to those who are eager to run in and take away the necessary ambiguity, the necessary moment of non-knowing, and to fill it up with knowing. False, reductionist, decontextualized, totally destructive, polarizing, divisive knowing, because it's something you can know. And it's better to have something you can know than not. And I would say that is just absolutely not true. And this is what I'm really getting at, is there's a deeper personal psychological realm of exploration and inquiry of who am I in this changing world? Who is this changing me? Mm-hmm. How is it changing me? And then who are you? Oh my gosh. Woo-hoo, that's another whole level, right? So so for me, what is really exciting is that kind of murky, blurry, under the ground, in the shadow, behind the curtain kind of place is really where hope is living. That's where the habits that aren't formed yet live. That's where the words we don't know yet, the possibilities of who we are that we've never met yet, the songs that we've not written. So I love that space. For me, that is the place where the good stuff is.
You've made me think in your answer about a couple of things. One, an artist from Minneapolis who was a guest on this show, Ricardo Levins Morales, has a beautiful piece of art called The Volcano. And he talks about hope springs from below. It's his idea, this metaphor. Mm. Once the change coalesces, it emerges forth.
I've been writing about that. I wrote this piece called What is Submerging, and then put together this new theory, actually, on it, called a phani poesis. And a phani means kind of hidden, and poesis is to become. And it's this hidden becoming, this unseen coalescing that makes it possible. That, you know, emergence is much, much later.
You know, I agree with you, but it strikes me that being comfortable with uncertainty like this, really taking advantage of it and reveling it, runs really counter to the imperative or the instinct in modern society to control. I mean, I think that's what's so disruptive about thinking with complex systems, is that it changes the way we think about what control is and if it's something we can even attain.
There's a deep metaphor of the factory. And the factory is like a machine, filled with machines, but it's a big machine. And this part does this thing, and this part does that thing. And these people do this part, and they, you know, then it goes this way. And it's not so different than the engine of a car, really. And you gotta have control of all the compartmentalized processes in order to produce the efficiency of the product. And so we have, unfortunately, taken this metaphor into our bodies, into our imaginations, into our language, into our way of thinking about the development of a human being, into our way of thinking about what education or health or law or gardening is. And so this thing that you're bringing up around control is definitely at the core of this mechanistic idea. And it's amazing the way that metaphor finds its way into our ideas about how to think about the future, how to deal with climate change, how to deal with a pandemic.
Right.
Right?
Is there an antidote, a different metaphor?
The challenge is, and I think this really is the challenge, is how to be suspicious of ourselves and recognize my epistemology, my way of thinking, my way of knowing this world is so imprinted with this metaphor that I actually can't trust myself not to keep making it. And every time I start to see that I want to approach climate change or the pandemic or my kids' education with eyes that are looking for optimization, efficiency, higher product level, you know, all of these things that are not the things that a meadow does. Mm-hmm. They are the things that a factory does. And what I need to be able to do is to emulate those processes of life that make life, and not those processes which actually produce decontextualized linear control strategies.
I was thinking, as you were talking about, you know, sort of not necessarily trusting yourself, I was thinking about how, you know, I try myself to always look for the systems and things, and I work in my classes with students to see the systems and things, but even on the best days, it still almost feels like I'm trying to think in a second language. And this brings me in our conversation to something that I keyed in on when I was looking through the website of the Bateson Institute, which was a phrase to invite chaos and trust complexity. And I think that trust, my sense is this notion of trust is the other side of letting go of the imperative to control. But I'm curious, that's how I'm interpreting those words on your website and in this conversation. I'm curious to hear you, to hear from you what you think of when you hear the word trust and trusting complexity.
I mean, I feel like we have to be careful with words because they lose their muchness so easily. And, you know, trust is this word, and I feel like it's very confusing. I walk across the room all day and I don't trust my feet to get there. I just go, right? And then when I sprain my ankle, I realize, oh, I can't trust this foot. Right. So let me rephrase it a little bit, because I think for me, and maybe this is a good rephrase, I'm just, you know, sort of thinking out loud here, but I when I see something where I can perceive that the complexity is alive, it's on, it hasn't been flattened, it hasn't been dissected, it's moving. It could be messy. It's twisting in ways that are still unpredictable. There is a wilderness in this situation. That to me shows movement. So what I trust right now is movement. It isn't even trust, it's attraction. I want to be in movement. I want to be where it's possible for things to continue to learn and grow and be. I do not want to be finding myself in a situation where everything's locked down. There's too much changing in our world, including myself, for me to be in a world where everything is locked around me. So for me, trusting the complexity could also be said as allow yourself to be attracted to the living movement, right? It's a lot safer to be in something that can move in times of change than to be in something that is rigid, whether that's your identity or your relationship or your idea of school or whatever it is. You know, at this point, there's one thing we have learned in the last couple of years, it's that we were capable of shifting things up pretty quickly.
This is such an important point. I think a lot of people really overestimate how fast radical behavioral and social change can happen. And then the pandemic hits and all of a sudden everything's different.
Right? All of those rules and regulations and you need to be at the office. No, we can't possibly have this meeting online. How many conferences did I cross a world for that I could have just beamed in? Mm-hmm. Right? There were all sorts of rules and regulations that were wildly unnecessary. And right now, I think these are the sort of questions that we need to be looking at.
On the topic of shifts, and I'm keenly interested in hearing your answer to this. You know, it's something that in one way or another, I ask everybody. You said a moment ago that you're attracted to that motion. You want to be in motion. I'm curious if is there some sort of shift, some sort of particular change, something perhaps truly radical that you would like to see unfold in your lifetime?
I think one of the most beautiful shifts that I have seen, and where I think there's just immeasurable potential, is actually in the relationship between parents and children, and not necessarily children, could be adult children. After all these years of, you know, the changes within and you've got to do the inner work and da 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 da, we, each of us as complex systems, exist because we exist in relationship. We exist in relationship with our microbiome, with the world around us. We exist in relationship with our language, our history, our memories, with our parents, our loved ones, our wounds, our stories, right? There's all these relational processes that we live within, mm-hmm. our cultures, our, right? Potatoes. When we're talking about shift and change and deep systemic work, for me, ultimately, what we're talking about is a shifting in those relationships. There's something I can do to shift my own perception of those relationships, but ultimately, we're in those relationships in togetherness. We're holding each other stuck in the double binds. you're not going to liberate yourself. I'm not going to liberate myself. But we can liberate each other. It's a little, you know, that cartoon about the guys and they all have these long spoons and they can't eat because they have to feed each other. You know, that thing. It's a little bit like that, where we have to actually set each other free of these illusions that our culture is made of. Culture is about relational process. So the communication of what it is to be success or lovable or sexy or is all relational, right? So we've got these kind of fixed ideas and roles of parents and children. And they're absolutely obsolete. I mean, what is it that I'm supposed to teach my children about the future they're headed into? I realize we're learning together. We're in a complete state of mutual learning. I do not know. They do not know. I have something to offer for sure, but I have a lot to learn too. And there are ways in which I've been trained to see, you know, those ossified scaffoldings that we were talking about earlier. That make it so that I can't perceive things that they can perceive.
Right. Or that the way that you and I see the world or perceive it seem invisible or absurd or sideways or less legible to them.
Right. One question that I found myself asking with my kids was, well, it's looking like the age of individualism is coming to an end. Mm-hmm. That didn't go so well. And so basically, these beings are going to need to be much better at being in mutual relational process. And I'm not going to be a very good teacher because I was hardwired from go to be a participant in an individualistic game. So it's going to be tricky for me to offer that teaching other than lip service, which quickly turns into identified hypocrisy if you have a teenager. but I thought the only thing I can really do to kind of play with this question is to rethink some things. How would I raise my children differently if they were never leaving home? Hmm. It shifts things, right? And you start to realize how much of our communication is laced with this kind of undertone of, yeah, but when you grow up, but when you get in the world, you're going to need to, but you know, I could be lenient on you, but the world out there is not going to be. And when you get your apartment and when you get married and when you have kids and when you have your job and when you paying these bills, then you'll know not to throw your clothes on the floor. Right. but there's always this written intrinsicness of when you individuate, that's sitting right there. When you're like me and you've been through the gauntlet, but I don't know. It's just a totally different alignment.
I sense something in what you just said that's very important. So thanks. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for being with me today.
Thanks. Thank you for having me. This has been really fun.
Thank you for listening. The Second Transition podcast is funded in part by the Errol Food Institute at the University of Guelph and by Voiced Radio. This episode was produced on the traditional lands and territories of the Washoe people in what is now known as Northeastern California. Today we heard from Nora Bateson. You can learn more about Nora and her work and the Bateson Institute in the episode notes. See you next time.